Welcome to Life List, a birding podcast.
Hello, hello, welcome, welcome, everybody. I am George Armistead. I am here with my co-host, Molly Brown, and a special guest today. We are Life List, a birding podcast. Molly, yeah. What have you been up to lately?
Well, I've actually been doing a good bit of birding lately. Just kind of slowing down on migration, seeing a lot of breeding birds, but I've had a few excuses to get out and do some day trips and just kind of hitting up areas that I haven't been to in a while. Been trying to be very intentional about like taking my time, really just taking things in. And I like this time of year. Migration's fun. I like the breeding birds and I really like June. I like just enjoying all of this. So I'm pretty happy.
Nice. Yeah, I kind of call this the off season, and I'm actually getting set to head out to the prairies of North Dakota and Montana to join our buddy Josh Coville for a tour, Hillstar Nature Tour. Looking forward to that, and we'll definitely have to detail some of the findings there when I get back. But yeah, I think we should not hold our audience in suspense. And that we should introduce our guest today that we're interviewing. Today we are interviewing Katie Fallon, who is the author of a couple nonfiction books, including Vulture, The Private Life of an Unloved Bird, and also Cerulean Blues, A Personal Search for a Vanishing Songbird. She's also co-authored a couple books for kids, including Look, See the Bird, and Look, See the Farm. Katie is also the executive director of the Avian Conservation Center of Appalachia. It's a nonprofit organization dedicated to conserving wild birds through research, education, and rehabilitation. She's based near Morgantown, West Virginia, and I know was out birding today with Molly, so you guys are practically neighbors. How are you doing today, Katie?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, we've been talking for a while about getting you on here, so we're excited to have you. How was your guys' walk this morning? What did you guys see?
It was a great walk. It was a young birders walk. We had about 20 kids and their families join us at the West Virginia Botanic Garden, which is a beautiful local place here near Morgantown, West Virginia, to see a variety of birds. This morning, I heard my first of the year yellow-billed cuckoo, and some of the kids got to see Louisiana water thrush, which is always cool, along a creek. Lots of red-eyed vireos, of course, scarlet tanagers. It was a little bit hot, so it quieted down pretty quickly, but it was a good morning. It's great to be outside. In addition to birds, we turned over a lot of logs and found eastern red-backed salamanders, and
oh, wow.
The kids got to pass those around a little bit gently.
Uh-huh.
you know, lots of spiders and other cool stuff to look at in addition to birds.
Yeah, you guys are in a good part of the world for herps out there.
We are.
Yeah. Quantity and quality, I'd say. You know, young birders walks, like, they're their own ball game, too. You've got to really keep attention for a while. and when it's hot and it's quieting down a little bit by 11 o'clock or so, then you start looking for stuff that will keep everyone happy.
Yes.
Look for some herps and butterflies.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly. Herps, butterflies, puddles, you know, are always good. Sticks that can be used as, you know, weapons or to write in the dirt mm-hmm. is good too. Sometimes we get a lot of very young kids on our kids walks, and it can be tough for kids, you know, under age 5 or whatever, or under age 10, really, to look through binoculars and actually find birds. Mm-hmm. So I tend to spend a lot of time talking about listening for birds and figuring out, you know, what does it sound like they're saying?
Mm-hmm. Nice. It's a good idea, actually, I think, for kids and adults to think about, like, the kinds of sounds they're hearing from these birds, you know, like whether it's a beautiful song or a harsh scold, you know, that they really can tell you, if you listen close, they often tell you how they're feeling.
Yeah, we had some house wrens telling us how they were feeling this morning when we were standing underneath their house.
They were giving you what for?
Certainly, they certainly were. Yep.
Nice.
But a great species for kids to see well with the naked eye is a turkey vulture. And we saw several of them today on the walk, and all the kids got to point and see them even without using binoculars. So that's always fun. And we watch them and we try to watch them and see when they flap. And today it was never. So
they just were coasting around, wings extended, riding updrafts and thermals.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely.
No, that's
cool. Looking good doing it.
Now, that is one of your favorite birds, right? You'd have to say, Katie, the turkey vulture.
Yes, the turkey vulture is probably my favorite bird species. There are so many wonderful things about the bird. And unfortunately, it's kind of an underrated or overlooked, sometimes even, you know, underappreciated or unloved bird. And I
was
going
to say, this is an unusual choice for a favorite bird, to be sure.
It is. It is. But there's so many wonderful things about them. I mean, they can take dead things and turn them into life. And I mean, a lot of animals do that, but turkey vultures are really one of the bigger species to do that. And they can clean up our highways of deer, which we have a lot of here in West Virginia. And they can, you know, eat animals that may otherwise contaminate the landscape. And they do a efficient job of quickly getting rid of those carcasses, and that can help stop the spread of disease or slow the spread of disease, not only by removing the carcasses outright, but also by reducing the concentration of mammalian scavengers like raccoons that swap a lot of saliva with each other while they're eating, and could potentially spread rabies, which nobody wants.
Yes, for real. Now, how did you come to your love for the turkey vulture?
Well, turkey vultures, you know, I think the first time I noticed turkey vultures was more than 20 years ago when I started volunteering at a small wildlife rehab center, and we got an injured turkey vulture in, and it was just like no other bird that I had seen up close before. I mean, you know, I don't want to say like, well, when you've seen one hawk, you've seen them all or something, but a turkey vulture is just a lot different. They're a lot different from other truly predatory raptors. Turkey vultures they always seem like they're observing quietly, you know, maybe trying to figure things out. They just look at you differently than some of the other birds do. And I found this turkey vulture that was in rehab just fascinating. And they're such a big bird with a big wingspan, you know, up to, you know, 5 or 6 foot wingspan, which is, you know, close to what a bald eagle has, but they weigh less than half of what a bald eagle weighs. So there's this huge, great big wings. And then the bird itself is very light, and it's a little strange. It's just a cool bird overall. And I really enjoy working with them.
They are fascinating birds. Crazy looking at times.
Yes, very crazy looking. Close. Yes, they have that. They're they're very beautiful up close, though. Even in their own way, they're from the ground. They often just look like big brown birds, but really up close, they're, you know, their feathers have like a purplish sheen sometimes, and some of the edges on their feathers are golden. When the sun hits them a certain way, they're almost, you know, iridescent, very glossy. Sometimes I think that the turkey vulture, I don't know if this is controversial or not, but there's a lot of talk of renaming certain bird species. And I think the turkey vulture is an excellent candidate for renaming because it's named because it looks sort of like another bird, turkey, which doesn't seem fair. And, you know, our New World vultures are not very closely related to vultures in Africa, Asia, and Europe. So calling all those birds vultures worldwide is not really accurate.
Yeah, and a little confusing.
This is confusing. So if I were in charge, I would call all the New World North and South American vultures condors. Nice. And turkey vulture could be the glossy condor, or the golden condor.
There you go. Now that has some romance to it. I like it.
Yeah. It does. Yeah. I mean, who's going to shoot a golden condor, right?
I love that you're coming on this podcast and publicizing this. Good pitch. Well, I saw that you put this on Facebook the other day too. Jimmy and I actually talked about it a lot, and we talk about bird names a lot on this podcast.
Oh, good.
What did you say?
Bronzed condor.
Was that one that came out? That was our favorite.
Bronzed condor. Yeah, that's a good one too.
I think that's a good name for him.
Cherry-headed condor. There's a lot of possibilities, but condors really, I think a more accurate term for the seven North and South American vulture species. That's all we got.
I remember talking to Alvaro a while ago about our New World vultures, condors, if you will, and him making note of the fact that. You know, I think a lot of people don't realize that in North America, our turkey vultures are primarily migrants. I guess there are some residents in parts. I'm not sure if this is well delineated. Actually, you probably know better than I do, Katie. But certainly in Central and South America, there are subspecies of turkey vultures that have different color heads from the ones we're accustomed to here, or they have little collars around the neck, you know, sort of whitish feathers. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's other species like the two species of yellow-headed vultures, which are really cool.
And you mean also, the forest condor and the savannah condor?
There you go. Yes. And they really do behave differently. I've seen many more lesser yellow-headed vultures than I have graders, but they really... That's a bird I see quite a bit on some of my Colombia tours and have seen elsewhere, Venezuela and number of spots. And they really behave differently. You know, often they seem like they have like a really bulbous hand, like the hand area seems kind of broader in the hand area of the wing. And they often are low. They're not, they don't go nearly as high as turkey vultures and do sort of a lot of these low swoops. So it's actually reasonably easy to photograph them compared to some others. But one of the things Alvaro pointed out was that vultures don't have a lot in the way of vocalizations, I gather. Now, as somebody that has worked with them closely, you would know that better than I do. But have you heard them making many sounds?
Oh, yes. We talk every day. I talk to the turkey vultures all the time. So at the Avian Conservation Center of Appalachia that we mentioned that I'm the executive director of, and we usually just say ACCA because the name is so long that we came up with. So at ACCA has three non-releasable turkey vultures in our care that we are permitted by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to keep for education. And we have one non-releasable black vulture. And the turkey vultures make, they do a variety of different sort of, I'm not even sure if hissing is the best way to describe it. It's more like breathing, making a breathing sound. And one of the turkey vultures in our care is named Vader because her breathing sounds sort of like Darth Vader. Nice. and they do that in a couple different situations. They have one sort of hiss or breath that they will kind of do at each other. If they're eating and one gets too close to the other one's food, they might make some different little hisses at each other. And then they definitely do one that it's almost like excitement or begging, like when they see us coming towards them with their food. And the black vulture makes some similar noises also, similar just kind of hissing, maybe a little bit of, I don't even think I would call it grunting, even though some people describe it that way, but it's almost like they have different loud breathing. They can sound sort of like a hot yoga class sometimes.
Yeah, I think it's interesting thinking about the neck pattern, head pattern, and I guess that was Al's point, is that in terms of pair formation, they don't really use voice as much. I would imagine that once they're paired up and they're at nests and stuff, or you know, on territories together, that they might use those hisses, like you say, for communication purposes at times. But that really, it seems like for pair formation, head color and head pattern appears to be probably an important thing for them when they're getting together.
I would think so. I mean, from what I've read, as far as we know, at least turkey vultures seem to be strong pair bonders, or, you know, mate for life, which is not, you know, I guess saying a strong pair bonder is probably more accurate. But if one of them dies, you know, they'll get another mate. But Hawk Mountain in Pennsylvania has done, near where George is, has done a lot of studies with transmitters on turkey vultures and wing tags on turkey vultures. And they've determined that even though both members of the pair might return to the same area to nest in the spring, they may spend the winter in different parts of the world. So, for example, there's a pair of turkey vultures that Hawk Mountain has tagged in Saskatchewan. It's one of the northernmost nests that they have transmitters and tags on birds. And the pair has been together, as far as I know, they're still together. And I think they put the transmitters on them maybe in 2009. And wow. One of the pair goes to Venezuela and the other one goes further into Colombia in the winter, like separate winter vacations.
Wow.
And then they come back to the same abandoned farmhouse in Saskatchewan to have their chicks every year, which is pretty cool.
Wild.
Yeah.
And speaking of turkey vulture migration, it's kind of fascinating that usually people divide turkey vultures into six different subspecies, but there's some debate, I guess, about that, depending on who you're asking. But most sources divide them into six subspecies, and each of them has a different migratory strategy. So the our birds in the eastern U.S. are considered partial migrants. So the birds that we have here in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, they may go to Florida for the winter, but they probably don't join that big river of raptors, you know, and head down to the tropics. They might also go to Georgia and stop, or North Carolina and stop, just depending on what the weather is doing and what the food availability is, and they're not moving very fast. Where we are in West Virginia, where Molly and I are, we have turkey vultures all year, but we have a lot fewer of them in the winter than we do in the spring and summer.
Mm-hmm.
But then the upper western birds, like the ones in Saskatchewan, are considered complete migrants, so they all leave that area. They all go you know, over Veracruz and into Central and South America. And then the third subspecies in North America is in the desert Southwest, Southern California, Arizona. And that subspecies is more like the eastern birds, that they're partial migrants. Some of them hang around Arizona all year, but some of them go to Panama.
Wow.
But that subspecies doesn't seem to cross the Panama Canal. So it's fascinating in a very nerdy way, like if you like turkey vulture migration. And then the subspecies in South America may even do a reciprocal migration and go further into the southern cone of South America when the bigger turkey vultures from North America get there in the fall, which is super cool.
And I think there's a couple populations, too, that are just totally resident in South America.
Yes.
Right.
The Falkland Islands.
Yeah, Falkland Islands one, mm-hmm. right? And then
yep.
I think one other someplace, I forget.
Caribbean Islands.
Okay.
Yeah. Usually turkey vultures on islands seem to stay.
Yeah.
You know,
it's interesting. If I recall, I think Puerto Rico didn't used to have too many turkey vultures, or they vanished, mm-hmm. but they've come back.
Oh, interesting.
They're only kind of in the arid southwest part of the island for the most part.
Hmm.
But yeah, fascinating bird is, one of the things we wanted, Molly and I were curious about is what, you know, working in animal rehab as much as you have, and your husband too, right, is a mm-hmm. vet. And, you guys, it looks like you have maybe 500 or more birds a year that come through the
yes.
facility. Would you say the turkey vulture is the one you've bonded with the most, or, and if so, what would some others be that you spend a lot of time with?
Well, right. So we get about 500 injured or displaced wild birds a year, and it's from all migratory species, all native migratory species, which includes everything you know, legally that includes everything from, you know, hummingbirds and robins to vultures and eagles, and nearly everything in between. It's not upland game birds or invasive species, but it's pretty much everything else. So the 500 or so birds we get are usually from about 60 different species of birds. And of course, the turkey vultures are, you know, probably my favorites. But we really don't get very many of them into rehab every year. And, you know, hopefully the turkey vultures aren't listening to what I'm going to say now, but probably my very favorite bird to work with is our non-releasable black vulture, who whose name is Maverick, because he was hit by a car in the parking lot of a bar called Mavericks. And back in 2014, and he was admitted for rehab in September of 2014. Actually, I got the call about this injured bird in the parking lot on International Vulture Awareness Day. And it was the day before I went into labor with my second child. So I was shuffling around a parking lot, you know, looking behind the dumpsters when I was like 8.5 months pregnant, trying to find this injured black vulture. And I couldn't find him. I couldn't find the bird. So we just kind of gave up. And then I went and had my daughter the next day. And then while we were in the hospital, still sort of recovering from that, we got a call from one of our volunteers that she had actually gone out and been able to capture the black vulture. And my husband, Jesse, who's a veterinarian, left me in the hospital and went in to check out the new patient, the new black vulture patient. And he called me when I was in the hospital, he called me and said, "Hey, this bird's not going to be releasable. It's got a shoulder injury. It's not going to be able to fly. You know, I'm just going to euthanize this bird." And which happens a lot, right? It sounds horrible to say, but you know, you get, we think euthanasia is often the kindest option, especially if a wild animal is not going to be able to return to the wild. The ones that we sort of decide to keep living under human care or transfer to other facilities have to be appropriate in a lot of different ways. So they have to have an injury that's not going to cause them pain in the long term, that's going to be able to allow them to move around pretty well. And we often prefer that the birds be young birds that may adapt to life under human care, you know, a little bit more readily than a bird that's been out in the wild, you know, doing its thing for years. Anyway, so he said, "I'm probably going to euthanize this bird." And I was, you know, in the hospital looking at my little newborn baby, and there's a lot of, you know, emotions and hormones and stuff. And it made me really sad to think about euthanizing this black vulture. So I said, "Hey, can you just maybe not do it like right now? Maybe not do that today." He said, "Okay, fine. The bird's okay. So we'll feed him and we'll come back to this later." So then we ended up naming my daughter, our daughter Cora, which of course is, you know, common raven shorthand, mm-hmm. but Coragyps atratus is also the scientific name for the black vulture.
Oh yeah, there you go.
So that's what we named our daughter. And that black vulture ended up to be so amazing and charismatic and took very, very quickly and easily to living with humans that we applied for the permit to keep him to use for education. And he's still with us, and he is an amazing, amazing bird who wins over a lot of hearts and minds for black vultures.
Nice. Wow.
He's my kids can feed him. He does puzzle toys made for dogs very, very fast. I mean, and it would take my beagle a much, much longer to figure out the puzzle feeders that this black vulture can figure out in a matter of seconds. He's a really amazing bird to work with.
A true maverick, sounds like.
Yes, he's top gun around here.
Oh, that is cool. And yeah, what does he eat mostly? What do you guys feed him?
Oh, Maverick likes a lot of different kinds of foods. So, I mean, probably the majority of what he eats is the white rats, you know, dead rats. They're readily available, rats and mice. But he also gets quail, chicken chicks, day-old chicken chicks. He gets salmon that he really enjoys, and other fresh fish. So we have a wonderful volunteer at ACCA who drives down once a week from Pittsburgh to volunteer, and he works at Whole Foods. And Whole Foods has been kind enough to donate fish to ACCA if the fish are like a little bit expired, or, you know, if someone wants to buy a fish and puts it in their shopping cart and then they decide they don't want to, they're not allowed to put it back on the shelf and resell it. And those fish were all being thrown away. And our volunteer said, "Hey, do you mind if I just take those?" And not for human consumption, but for vulture and eagle consumption. And the store said it was fine. So once a week we get fresh fish.
Wow.
And some really nice, like red snapper and, you know, whole fish, often black bass and salmon. So Maverick gets fish usually twice a week.
It sounds like Maverick does not suffer too much when it comes
he does not.
To the cuisine. Yeah.
He does not suffer. He also likes watermelon. He likes hard-boiled eggs. And he also really, really gets excited about archery-killed white-tailed deer ribs, which we have some friends who are hunters who will donate archery-killed deer pieces that we thaw in little chunks and give to the vultures. And that seems like a real, really exciting treat for them too.
Now, I think turkey vultures have really well-developed olfactory senses, right? And I think black vultures, not quite so much. They're more visual. Is that right?
Yes. Yep. Yeah. Turkey vultures have an excellent sense of smell. And I believe so do the lesser and greater yellow-headed vultures from the tropics that you mentioned. Turkey vultures use both their excellent sense of smell and their excellent vision to find food. But black vultures, at least as far as I know and from what I've read, they do not seem to have a well-developed sense of smell, but they do have excellent eyesight, and they will follow turkey vultures to food and sometimes fly up, higher than turkey vultures and see where they're going and follow them and then displace them at a carcass.
Hmm. Sneaky guys. Very smart.
Very smart. Yeah. I mean, Maverick is this interacting with our captive black vulture, certainly not the same, you know, as in the wild, but he investigates everything. He picks up new objects immediately. I had a sandal on one day and I got like a rock in my sandal and I took off my sandal and he ran over and grabbed it and ran away with it like a puppy in his mouth. And he, you know, was investigating it with his beak, running his beak across on the buckles of my sandals and everything. He is just always investigating everything that's going on around him. And he also will play fetch sort of with plastic ball pit balls, like colored balls that, you know, might have jumped around in at a Chuck E. Cheese or whatever. And these plastic ball pit balls, he likes the purple ones the best. I'm not sure why. I can't really explain the behavior. I don't know why he would chase balls around that are, you know, bouncing around his enclosure, but he does. And I've actually seen videos of wild black vultures playing with soccer balls and stuff like that that have been left on fields. So
that's wild. I didn't realize that. Is play supposed to be, if you see things playing, right? That's, if they're entertaining themselves, that's supposed to be a real sign of intelligence.
That's what I've heard. And I'm not sure if they have done, you know, tests on black vulture intelligence, but I would be really interested in hearing more about them if anyone has done that or participating in them, because our Maverick is a really inquisitive, special bird.
Hmm. Well, this area that Molly and I visited in February, the Central Andes, when you fly in, the main airport there is Pereira, and when you get there, I've always noticed, once I arrive in Pereira and get a look around at the skies, you know, you're like, all right, I'm in Colombia. This is the coffee triangle, you know, and it's, you're excited to start looking around for birds. And the one thing I'm always struck by upon arrival in Pereira, if the weather is decent, it's not raining or something, there are just black vultures everywhere. Just, they fill the skies around there. I don't think I've ever seen so many black vultures anywhere else as I have there. So, If you haven't been, we'll have to get you there just so you can feel immersed in large numbers of black vultures.
I have been to Colombia. Awesome. I would love to go back to Colombia someday. It was just a fabulous place to visit. And if you're a birder of any kind, I mean, Colombia, you have to go, right? Colombia is truly, truly amazing. I really hope to get back there someday soon. But yes, I think the first bird I saw in Colombia was a black vulture at the airport.
Uh-huh. Makes sense.
Yes. Yeah. And I flew into Bogota. And I also flew to Bucaramanga.
Oh yeah,
and okay. And I actually think that was the airport with all the black vultures.
Interesting, nice.
But I didn't see any other vultures besides turkey vultures and black vultures when I was there, unfortunately. Yeah. So I got to go back and see more.
Yeah, for sure.
I was there looking for smaller birds, I guess.
Uh-huh. There's plenty of those. That's for
yes.
sure.
Yeah. Well, was going to Colombia part of your research for the Cerulean book?
It was. Yep. Okay. Yep. Yep. Yeah. I went to Colombia as part of when I was working on my Cerulean Warbler book. And I didn't think it's been, 11 or 12 years ago now, which doesn't seem like it was that long ago, but it was. Mm-hmm. And when I was working on that book, I didn't realize that I was going to be able to go to Colombia. I was just writing about ceruleans and the breeding season and some of the conservation issues that they faced here in the eastern U.S. And then I learned that there was a cerulean warbler and golden-winged warbler summit happening in Colombia. And I was afraid to go because Colombia seems scary sometimes if you, before you go there. But I did go. And it was, amazing. And I would love to go back again. And we saw ceruleans there. It was October when we went, and we saw ceruleans and golden wings in Colombia.
Oh, wow.
Along with all kinds of other, amazing birds. And I'm sure I missed more, more species than I actually identified, because there are so many hummingbirds and and everything else. I need to go back and do that again. The field guide that I had for the birds of Northern South America was like the giant 600 page thing that I was trying to carry around with me.
Oh yeah. Remember that book, Robin Restall, who actually just passed a few days ago. It was a tremendous book that he and his co-authors put together there. That is the hot zone up there for ceruleans. I think that, and there is, as I'm sure you know, there's now a cerulean warbler reserve in Colombia.
George, I was there.
Yeah.
I have a tattoo of the logo.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow. I'm the only one on this recording who doesn't have a bird tattoo yet. I'm going to have to, or a bird related tattoo at least. Remedy that in the not too distant future here.
Yeah, the Cerulean Warbler Reserve is a great, wonderful place to visit near the town of San Vicente de Chucurí,
nice.
Which is an awesome, awesome town with a lot of music and great places to eat.
Yeah, I think I still need Cerulean Warbler for my Columbia list, so I'm going to have to make it over there. I do remember seeing, I'll never forget birding the coastal range in Venezuela. At Henri Pittier National Park, and this would have been in the early mid 2000s, and seeing a huge flock, one of these huge feeding flocks moving through. We were kind of up in the Rancho Grande area and watching this flock just move along the hillside. Beautiful jungle, incredible birding place. And I think there was like 70 birds and, songbirds moving in this flock, and 10 of them were adult male ceruleans. And this is like January, February. And I just remember I was out of my mind. I was like, oh my God, it's like the mother load of cerulean warbler. They were all males. It was pretty interesting.
Wow.
Like, didn't see any females.
I mean, that's really cool. It seems so hard to see, our, in quotation marks, songbirds, in South America in the Central America in the non-breeding season and the non-breeding plumage when they're not really singing. And they're in mixed species flocks. Like, that's just seems, it seems it's a lot more challenging. At least it seems to me.
Yeah. They're not singing as much and they're with a completely different cast of characters. Pretty wild when you see them.
Yes.
That.
Yeah. And I find it just fascinating how many, If you, you know, think about the importance of something like shade grown coffee, you know, bird friendly coffee to birds, just visiting that part of the world and seeing all of the birds sort of squished into a relatively small area. I mean, I think wood thrush really, they spend the winter in like two countries in Central America, I think, right? I mean, it's a very, very small, small range to fit, you know, the entire species of wood thrush in. I mean, how important is protecting, you know, that habitat there and, yeah, you know, critical. Right. So we did visit some farms, coffee farms when we were in Colombia, and the cerulean warblers that I saw were in a coffee farm.
Wow.
In some trees, along with some crazy species of, you know, tanagers and things that it's just it's amazing what these birds see and live with throughout the year. I mean, they go from, you know, oropendulas and toucanets and stuff in the winter, and then come back, you know, and have Carolina chickadees,
yeah,
and you know, white-breasted nuthatches and stuff next door. It's really, yeah, kind of amazing.
It is. I was thinking about that when Molly, when we were at Tinamou in
what I was just thinking about.
Yeah, and there was some warblers there, but there was a ton of Acadian flycatchers, like so many Acadian mm-hmm. flycatchers there. I think it was like 10 or 12 or something we had over the course of our morning there, and I was like thinking the same thing, like here they are next to, like, you know, scrub tanagers and yeah. spiely-vented hummingbirds and you know motts and all sorts of other stuff, and like, yeah, they're gonna go home, and you know, they're you know, every now and then, I think I did see one in the same area as a Swainson's thrush, and I was like, oh, that's cool, you know, those guys, maybe yeah. they'll meet up someplace back north, but
yeah, maybe they'll just be like neighbors, you know, back here in West Virginia. Well, Swainson's thrush, I guess on their way elsewhere most of the time. But yeah. something that's really cool too, that I spend probably, you know, more time than I need to admit doing is like looking at eBird lists for some of these, you know, hotspots or coffee locations in Central and South America, just to sort of see where people see our species next to, you know, like,
oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And it's amazing to think about, the diversity of bird life that these little guys spend
yeah, where
time
they
with.
Intersect, and you're right, a lot of them have much more restricted ranges where they winter than yes. they do up north here.
Wonder what the life list of a typical cerulean warbler would be.
Yes, yeah. That's a good question.
Probably crosses water mostly at night, I guess. So they maybe their seabirding list wouldn't be as good as it could be. But who knows, maybe mm-hmm. they even get some stuff out at sea, you know?
Yeah, they could get those those nocturnal flight calls.
Here was a good one, sort of rando thought, was I got Jeremiah Trimble sent me an eBird list from Colombia, and I believe it was well offshore. I want to say it was like 20 miles out, and there was an oil bird seen circling the boat.
Wow.
And I think this is actually a topic we're going to visit at some point, is weird non-pelagics seen pelagically. So we'll tease that down the road. Jeremiah, thanks for sending that along, because that was a pretty wild one. It's impossible to think. But, you know, we do see warblers on some of our pelagics. So
landing on the boat?
Yeah, sometimes landing on the boat, right. Yeah.
I feel like I've seen some pictures of warblers and such on like oil rigs in the Gulf.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. For sure.
Yeah, like pictures from non-birders that just yes. see like whatever, a black Bernian hanging out with them for the day or something.
Yes.
Like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a friend who has spent some time in Haiti, like months to weeks to months at a time living in Haiti, and he's not a birder, but he sent back pictures of a black-throated blue warbler, and American redstart, and he didn't know what they were, but they were on Haiti.
Wow. And there was Al's mashup where he had a Tennessee warbler and a Hawaiian petrel on one of his pelagic trips in the same
day.
Pretty interesting, a rare warbler to get out there in a cool matchup. But Yeah, so we are on the home stretch here for our time. Katie, we wanted to ask you, Molly in particular was curious about your experience running for political office. Maybe you want to tell folks a little bit about that.
Sure. So I ran in last election cycle, so 2022. I ran for West Virginia House of Delegates, which is our state legislature. We had some redistricting, or you know, gerrymandering, however you want to call it, here in West Virginia. So it was a new district, and I got somehow talked into running for the seat, for the open seat. And I've never done anything like this before. And I did not want to do it at first. I said no, and I sort of cried and had like a panic attack. And then, my husband said, "Oh my gosh, Katie, you have to be the change. Like, you really should do this. This is going to be great. You know, our kids will see it, and it will be, inspiring maybe, or, you know, an interesting experience for them. And we should really do it. And if you lose, then it doesn't matter. It's not your, it's not your career. You'll go back to being the same Katie." I said, "Sure. Okay, fine. We'll give it a try." And I've got three kids. They're all under age 10 and they're all girls. And, we still don't see a lot of women politicians, right? There still is a great, great many more men in the U.S. holding elected office than there are women. So, and here in West Virginia, it's even more so. I think currently we have one Democratic female representative in our West Virginia House of Delegates. Mm. So that's not very good, right?
Yeah.
So I gave it a shot. I lost by 130 votes, which was very close. It was the closest losing race in any of the House of Delegates races. So I was like the first loser, I guess. but it was kind of cool that I came so close. The person that I lost to was also a woman, but she is the wife of our current Secretary of State. Who is now, her husband is now running for governor of West Virginia. So they are a very well-connected political family. Mm-hmm. So I was expected to lose, and I was expecting to lose, but the fact that I came, so close, was kind of exciting.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it took forever to get the results too, right? I mean,
yes. Yeah. I mean,
it had to.
I eventually sort of just stopped checking because they hadn't called the race for days to weeks. It was still listed as like uncalled or whatever. And I eventually figured, well, I mean, I they did all the canvassing and stuff like that. And, you know, I maybe got a couple more votes and she got a couple more votes, whatever, when they count all the absentee ballots and all the people who, you know, do something wrong, filling out their ballot. But it was, yeah, close, and it wasn't called for a long time. And overall, I was really worried running for office that some creepy, weird things would happen, because I guess I'm either like the oldest millennial or one of the youngest Gen X people. And I guess if asked, I will claim Gen X. but it's
strong Gen X.
Yes. Yeah. Gen X. I guess I'm cynical, you know, I'm cynical. I imagined like that there would be something very dishonest or dirty or underhanded or cheating or whatever would be happening in state politics. And maybe I just didn't do it for long enough yet, but the whole election running for office thing was pretty good overall. Good experience. My kids had fun. We marched in all the parades. You know, we marched in the homecoming parade and the pride parade and the fair parade. And they all wore their Katie Fallon shirts, which was a little weird to wear a shirt with my own name on it. But You know, and it, but it was fun. And my, we had a local guy do a logo that was a little bird. That that was a really cool. I liked seeing the little bird on the signs. And, you know, I had a really great political website that was, you know, designed by our friend Molly here.
Oh, thanks.
So it was overall fun, kind of fun. I mean, weird to talk about yourself, but also kind of fun to, you know, meet people and, I don't know, talk about stuff that you might not normally have an opinion about. And I learned a lot. I learned about things I usually think mostly about, you know, birds and the environment and ecosystem health in general. And I think about my kids' schools a lot because they go to public school and I want good public schools. But so those things were important to me when I ran, but I also learned about, you know, the foster care system in West Virginia. Like, we have more kids in foster care per capita than any other state. And I learned about our opioid problem. And our, you know, our roads are terrible and all kinds of other things that I hadn't really thought much about before running.
Yeah. It's pretty interesting to think that you start, like in your case, running for the platforms that you care most about, and then you have to represent an entire district. So then, yeah, you have to gain that perspective. Right. I guess kind of all in an election cycle, which is probably how it happens a lot for newcomers into local elections. Like, you're deciding what within the year of it or something, that it's an opportunity.
Yeah, it's very short. It's a short time to figure out a lot of stuff. The learning curve is steep. You have to learn a lot of stuff really fast. And there are a lot of rules about fundraising, and the fundraising piece is really weird. And I sort of wanted to be like, hey, I really would like to win this election, but I know about this great nonprofit that you can donate to instead of my campaign. And it was sort of a weird to have to fundraise, but you have to fundraise to buy all your stuff. Like, if you want to have any signs or mailers or t-shirts, you can't really just, like, you have to declare where all that money comes from, which is a good thing, but it's kind of a pain, actually.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely a learning curve.
But everyone should run for office, though. So that's my everybody should run for office if you can. If you can pull it off, if you can win, great. But if you don't win, run anyway. We really have to keep throwing. I think we have to keep throwing good people at the machine.
Yeah.
And sure. Eventually, you know, more good people run, then more good people will get in.
Nice. You going to do it again?
Maybe. I'm not sure if I'm going to do it this time or not, but I maybe will do it again in the future. I mean, my youngest child is 4, which is pretty young, and I might wait a couple years till everybody's a little bit more
independent.
Yeah, but who knows? I mean, it was good overall.
Nice.
That's cool. There's a pretty cool coalition of women that are running for office in West Virginia that feels like it's kind of starting to build. I mean, I know you were inside that a lot more than what I see from the outside, but like, my grade school science teacher was running in the county over, and it feels to me, just from the perspective that I have, like there's a little bit of momentum building there. And
I think
it's awesome.
There were I met a lot of great candidates throughout the state, you know, most of whom didn't win.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I don't think any of them won, and there were some really great incumbents, who also were kind of unseated in this last election cycle, which is kind of unfortunate. West Virginia House of Delegates has, I think now out of 100 members, I think 11 are Democrats. So it's a very, red legislature. But I met a lot of really cool people running for office throughout the state, who were, you know, smart and hardworking, and also got talked into running, I think. But hopefully there is some momentum. There is some momentum, and people will keep going and keep trying, because the state, you know, needs good people to run. West Virginia has so many awesome, awesome things. I mean, we have all those salamanders and, you know, all the breeding warblers and the mountains and the whitewater rafting and hiking and, just some and nice people and so many good things that we need to do a better job with our politics. Get that up to speed.
Hear, hear.
Well, yeah.
Nice.
Speaking as the sole millennial on this podcast, I guess, who is watching this happen, especially in West Virginia, I think it looks like things are, there's progress and there's momentum building. So it's pretty cool.
Excellent.
Hi. Nice. Well, thanks so much for doing this today, Katie. It was a real pleasure to have you on. And I hope you've gotten to enjoy some post-election time with the family and with Maverick and everybody. But we look forward to keeping tabs on you and probably having you back on some other time. But hope all thank goes good there in West Virginia.
Yes, thank you very much for having me. It's great to talk to both of you, and congratulations on the excellent podcast and all the good work that you do with For Birds
and people.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and we'll put links for all of your projects and books and the ACCA and everything else I can think of in the show notes too, so everyone can check that out.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank Great. You.
Yeah, well, thanks for listening, everybody. We will be back again with another episode soon. Check out Life List to Birding Podcast for more info, and we'll be back at you soon. Take care.
Bye, everyone. Bye.